God says, jump, and I'll catch you. And in a mysterious way, we're not called to work for God, but we're called to let God work through us. And so in Genesis 17, we continue in our series. The whole series is called Abraham Living the Life of Faith. And this morning, in a few minutes, we'll read chapter 17, and our title of the topic is God Who Fulfills All His Purposes. And in this chapter, we see a mixture of divine sovereignty and human responsibility. And we will learn how God works to accomplish obedience in Abram's life and ours. And I figure we're sort of about halfway through the series now, and I figured we might as well just do a little bit of a quick recap. And when we began our studies, Abram, back in Genesis 12, he was just 75 years of age. And I say just, because people lived quite a bit longer back then. And in fact, Abram lived a further 100 years, and he died when he was 175. And we began our studies in chapter 12, where God institutes an unconditional covenant with Abram. God made several promises to him that require nothing back from him. He said, I will make you into a great nation, I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. All the families on earth will be blessed through you. Now the first two promises were blessings to Abram, and the third promise was a blessing through him to all people of all time. And so in obedience to God, Abram, at 75 years old, left family, clan, and land to follow God's call to go to Canaan and claim the promises that God had made to him. Over the next 10 years, there were a number of challenges, which we've looked at some of. There was the famine, there was a trip to Egypt, there was an accumulation of wealth there, there was the return to the promised land, there was war between kings, and there was rescue of his nephew Lot. But after 10 years, when Abram is about 85, God reaffirms his promise to Abram and makes a covenant with him that Abram would not be childless. And we read this in Genesis 15. Tarsus spoke about this 2 weeks ago, about this reaffirmation of the covenant, and he reminded us of the incredible significance of the unconditional nature of that covenant. It was instituted by God. It was promised by God, and it was based entirely on the faithfulness of God. After all, as Tarsus said, if it was left to us, it would be doomed to failure. And it's at this point, if we read chapter 16, we would see that Abram's wife Sarai sought to resolve the problem of her barrenness and gave her maidservant Hagar to Abram to bear a child on her behalf. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. So we arrive at chapter 17, our text for this morning. The setting is now 13 years later, and Abram is 99 years old, and God appears again to Abram to reaffirm his covenant with him. And so this morning, rather than I read it, and to give you a little break from my voice, what I've done is I have a little video where the verse of that chapter will be read out loud. And I'm going to take a seat, and I hope you enjoy hearing this reading of this chapter.
Genesis 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, I am God Almighty. Walk before me, be blameless. I will confirm my covenant between me and you, and will greatly increase your numbers. Abram fell face down, and God said to him, As for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham. For I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. Then God said to Abraham, as for you, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, the covenant you are to keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You are to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised, including those born in your household or bought with money from a foreigner, those who are not your offspring, whether born in your household or bought with your money, they must be circumcised. My covenant in your flesh is to be an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. God also said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Abraham fell face down. He laughed and said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And Abraham said to God, if only Ishmael might live under your blessing. Then God said, yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and will greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year. When he had finished speaking with Abraham, God went up from him. On that very day, Abraham took his son Ishmael, and all those born in his household or bought with his money, every male in his household, and circumcised them as God told him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised, and his son Ishmael was 13. Abraham and his son Ishmael were both circumcised on that same day. And every male in Abraham's household, including those born in his household or bought from a foreigner, was circumcised with him.
What an amazing chapter. I was going to say it was a challenge to talk or to look into it, but it's actually been very much a blessing. And there are, I'd like to bring 4 points on this chapter, just sort of as we work our way through. The first one you can see there is the promise to Abram, the first 8 verses. And then I want to bring 3 practical applications. I've called them the word for today, which was how we'll finish this part. The promise to Abram, first 8 verses. We've already looked at the promise that has been repeated by God several times to Abram, and yet it was an incredible promise to make to an old man, and we can hardly blame Abram if he had trouble believing it. Even though God repeated this each time across the years, it's still hard for Abram to take it in. Every time God repeats it, he adds a bit more detail. At the beginning in chapter 12, I will make a great nation from your descendants. But then he becomes very specific, you will have a son. And then God adds promises concerning the nation. He says, to your descendants, I will give the land from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. And finally, God makes an unconditional promise to fulfill everything that he has promised. His word is his word. And so now 24 years have passed since that first meeting in Abram was 75. He's now 99. He has no child except the son born through Hagar, his wife's maidservant. Surely God has forgotten his promises, or perhaps he's changed his mind. So much time has gone past. And just at that moment of despair, God comes again to Abram at the beginning of chapter 17, and he says, he gives four promises, four more details. Your name will be changed to Abraham, which is father of many people. Many kings and nations will come from you. I will make an everlasting covenant with your descendants, and I will give the whole land of Canaan to your descendants. How could Abraham believe such promises? The answer comes at the very start of our reading in verse 1, and is the name which God uses to describe himself to Abraham. He introduces himself as, I am the Lord Almighty. And in the Hebrew, there's two words, El Shaddai. The phrase means something like the God who moves mountains. And when I was studying this chapter, the El Shaddai title is used in so many different ways and can mean so many things. It's a huge study just in itself. But for this morning, the phrase means the God who moves mountains. It was God's way of saying, Abram, what are you worried about? I can make mountains. I can move mountains. If I want to, you will have a son when you are 100 years old. This is no problem to me. What are you worried about? God was about to do something unimaginable. He was about to implement the plan that he had presented when he first called Abram, a plan to give the aged Abram and Sarai a child. You see, Abram is now starting to learn that God is relational, that he can connect with God. The remarkable truth is that El Shaddai, the Almighty Lord, is personally knowable and was committed to a humble man living in the wild regions of Canaan. In addition, this promise was available to all who would come from Abram's offspring. A promise applied by Paul in Galatians 3 verse 9 to all who would believe in Christ down through the ages. And so in verses 5 and 6, Abram's name is now changed. And this name change is crucial. The name Abram, meaning exalted father, implies that Abram came from some royal lineage. But in Hebrew, Abraham sounds similar to father of a multitude. And Daniel presented this to us in the very first of our series. His new name implied a look ahead to his future descendants. His new name and his wife's new name were perpetual reminders of God's sure and certain word. Every time someone addressed Abraham from now on, he would recall God's promise until finally Isaac, the child of promise, would arrive. See, God had promised the impossible. So why did God promise that Abram would have a son and then wait almost 25 years? Why wait 25 years? Very simply, it's because now that Abram is 99 and Sarai is 90, there is no question that a son could only come from God. There was no human ability for this to happen. It had to be a miracle. And so I encourage you, some people, some in our fellowship here, may be waiting and waiting and waiting for God to act in a particular way. It does not mean he's forgotten. It does not mean that you're off his agenda, or you're dropped to the bottom of the pile, or you're being thrown out of the pile. God doesn't have a waiting list like the hospital does, right? Or a waiting list to get onto the waiting list. No. You are always at the top of God's mind. God's timing is always going to be perfect. You should never forget that he truly is El Shaddai, the Lord Almighty. And so in our second point, this is the sign of the covenant, verses 9 to 14. So the promise of a son and a change of name is not the whole story. Once God gave this incredible promise, he told Abraham and the other men to do something pretty radical. He ordered them to be circumcised. Now, if I was Abraham, I'd probably be thinking, really? But in verse 11, God calls it the sign of the covenant. So although God's promises were unconditional, Abraham's participation in God's blessing was centered on his faithfulness and obedience to God's commands. See, when God says, you shall, he is not saying, my will is dependent upon your action. God does not say, you must do this, and if you don't, I won't do what I've promised. God doesn't act like that. God is sovereign. God is going to do what he will do. But it is no less true and no less important that we must do something. And in the case of Abraham, he was to circumcise himself and every male in his household. The word circumcision literally means cutting around. It refers to an operation that removes the foreskin from the male organ. And only males underwent the circumcision, of course. And in the patriarchal society of ancient Near East, people considered that a girl or woman who shared the condition of her father, if she was single, and she would share this condition of her husband if she was married. Now, God chose circumcision as a symbol for at least three reasons, and these have an amazing prophetic note to them. And you see them there. The first one, the first three, physical circumcision. It identifies the man as part of God's covenant. It was a physical reminder of sexual and spiritual fidelity. And it was an illustration of God's approach to dealing with the flesh. So the first one, it identifies the man as being part of God's covenant. This would have been a frequent reminder to every circumcised male of God's promise. Circumcision, by its nature, touches the very core of what it means to be a man. In his most personal moments, every Jewish male would forever be reminded that he was a holy son of the covenant and that he belonged to God. It might be personal, but once he was circumcised, he could never forget it. And note this, circumcision did not make a person part of the covenant. It was not the entry pass to get into the covenant. A man was circumcised because he was part of the covenant. He was in the covenant, and so as a sign, he was circumcised. Secondly, physical circumcision was a physical reminder of sexual and spiritual fidelity. Circumcision was to remind the man that he must be faithful to the Lord and free from all sexual immorality. Abraham had committed sexual immorality by sleeping with Hagar. But now he was to submit to God. Circumcision was a sign that every part of a man's body must be devoted to the Lord. Every part. And thirdly, physical circumcision was an illustration of God's approach to dealing with the flesh. The circumcised male was one who rejected the flesh, the simply physical and natural aspects of life, in favour of trust in the Lord and his spiritual promises. Circumcision didn't save Abraham or make him righteous before God. His righteous standing before God was on the basis of faith, and his standing before God meant he had to rid himself of everything and anything impure. Now we transfer that to the New Testament. And in the New Testament, the physical act of circumcision is no longer required for believers. But we do read in Colossians 2:11 that we are to be spiritually circumcised. Now, I didn't have enough space on the slide to slot this in because I wanted to have the physical and spiritual there so you could compare. But I'll read Colossians 2:11. It says, when you came to Christ, you were circumcised, but not by a physical procedure. Christ performed a spiritual circumcision, the cutting away of your sinful nature. All right? Spiritual circumcision. And interestingly, the spiritual circumcision mirrors the three points about the physical circumcision. The first one is that spiritual circumcision is an expression of our identification with Christ. Just as physical circumcision simply showed that Abraham was part of God's amazing covenant, water baptism, taking communion, going to prayer meetings are only outward demonstrations of an inward faith. They cannot save us of themselves. They simply show that we are already one with Christ. And so the spiritual, getting rid of the dross, the stuff in our lives that we don't need, that is an expression of our identification with Christ. We belong to Christ, and so he performs this act. Secondly, is an expression of spiritual faithfulness to the Lord. As people who have accepted the forgiveness offered by Jesus Christ, we are to express our own faithfulness to him in every aspect of our lives. We are to have no reliance upon ourselves, but have total reliance upon him. Every decision we make should be made with the intent of trying to honour God and being faithful to his name. And thirdly, it is an expression of cutting off or putting to death the sinful nature. See, God hates sin. So should we. We should too. Not wrong to hate sin. God knows how sin so easily entraps us. And so he gives us all the help he can to avoid it. But we must also play a part. We must flee from temptation. We must cut off everything that might draw us away from God. We must hate sin just as God does. You see, circumcision, to sum up the slide, circumcision for Abraham had huge depth of meaning and promise and hope. And the same goes for us in our Christian walk. Our identification with Christ, it demonstrates a life full of meaning and promise and hope. And so on to our third point, the promise to Sarai, verses 15 to 22. Just in case Sarai should feel left out, God now gives several specific promises to her. Her name will now be Sarah, which means princess. She will soon give birth to a son, and through that son she'll become the mother of many nations. This is a vast demonstration of God's grace. The last time we saw Sarai in chapter 16, she was urging Abraham to sleep with Hagar in order to help God out, so she thought. Then she began mistreating Hagar when the girl became pregnant. It's not actually a pretty story. And yet God includes her in his promises to Abraham. Though she is far from perfect, she too will be included in God's plan. It's as if God is saying, look, don't worry, Sarah. I'm going to bless you in spite of yourself. And that's often what God does, isn't it? He blesses us in spite of the things we do and the things we are, in spite of ourselves. This is one of the great themes of the story of Abraham. Whatever God does, he does in spite of us, not because of us. God knows that we are very much less than perfect, that we have faults, that we cannot measure up to his standards. He knows that there's nothing we can ever do that will make him owe us something. Yet he loves to give, he loves to bless, he is truly compassionate and slow to anger. And so whatever God does, he does in spite of us, not because of us. And that's why we shouldn't be surprised by God's promise in verse 19, Sarah, your wife, will give birth to a son for you. You will name him Isaac. And so after 24 years of waiting, God now pins down that almost the date when Isaac will arrive. Abraham is going to celebrate his 100th birthday by painting the nursery and changing nappies. The whole story is pretty amazing. It's pretty comforting because it drives home the point that God is never early and never late. His timing is always perfect. And I guess I'm going to show my age now, but back in the days of black and white TV, when there were big TVs and small screens, and they weighed a ton, there was a program called Candid Camera. Oh, a lot of people remember that. And their catchphrase, they would say this every time at the end of the program, somewhere, sometime, when you least expect it, someone will say, "Smile, you're on Candid Camera." And that rings a bell for some people. If you're younger than me, look it up on YouTube. I'm sure there's something on there. You see, God often seems to work on the Candid Camera principle. When you least expect it, and often when you have given up hope, God comes through just in the nick of time. In the nick of time. It is always the right time. And so the fourth point, the act of obedience, our last five verses, 23 to 27. Our story contains one final detail. After God finished speaking and left Abraham, he was circumcised. Verse 23 specifies that it happened on that very day. This was instant obedience. And it also says that Abraham had Ishmael and all the other men in his household circumcised. This is complete obedience. It was Abraham's way of saying, "Lord, I believe every word you say is true, and I'm going to believe it even if I don't understand it." So here is proof of Abraham's faith. A few minutes ago he'd been laughing in wonder, but now he is circumcised to seal his dedication and consecration to God and his word. We might struggle to understand everything about God, but that should never stop us from having complete and utter trust and confidence in him. Do you understand how your cell phone works? Put money on that most of us will say no. Does that stop us from using it or having faith and confidence in it? No. It's only a cell phone. Why not the same with God? Why not the same with God? God is saying, "Jump and I will catch you. Jump and I'll catch you." And so, the word for us today. We've looked at the chapter. What does it mean for me when I walk out that door? Three very quick things. The first one is, El Shaddai is still able to move mountains for his people. That's why Jesus said to his disciples that through faith in God, they could move mountains. Don't despair if you are facing a mountain today. This week I came across an interesting definition of faith. It was, faith is telling the mountain to move and then being totally surprised if it doesn't. Think about it. Faith is telling a mountain to move and then being totally surprised if it doesn't. So you see in this name El Shaddai so many different facets of God, so many different ways to understand this God who desires a covenant with us, this God who invites us to be in a relationship with him. He's willing to be sufficient. He's willing to be the shelter. He's willing to be the sinless one who pardons your sin. He is certainly a God of blessing and a God of comfort, a God of peace and a God of protection. Whatever your need is this morning, and we will all have them, there's no one here who won't have some sort of need. It is neither too small to be important nor too big to be unheeded. El Shaddai will come through. But it leads into the second point. His timing is always perfect. Learning to trust God means believing God's timing is always perfect. He never fails. God is never late and he's never early. Now, we might want the answer to something to come along really soon. We'd write like, "Oh, God, help us out now." And we get a bit impatient. But if delivering on something or other that we need relied on us, then it wouldn't be faith, would it? We must trust God the same as Abraham did. God's best for you will always be delivered on its God-ordained due date. It will never be early, but it will never be late. And so lastly, we all need to be spiritually circumcised today. The circumcision that God requires is the circumcision of the heart. And we have that in that verse, Romans 2, verse 29, where we read, "And true circumcision is not merely obeying the letter of the law, rather it is a change of heart produced by the Spirit. And a person with a changed heart seeks praise from God, not from people." That's tough, isn't it? We all like to get a bit of human praise. We don't mind a pat on the back. But that's not what we're supposed to do. We are to seek praise from God. Note this carefully. Circumcision, although it was a physical mark on the body, was never meant to be an end in itself. The physical mark was meant to be accompanied by a deep spiritual commitment to God. Where commitment was absent, circumcision simply deteriorated into ritualism. And just as that gradually happened in the Jewish race, so it can also happen in our modern Christian church. We have to be careful that those things that should demonstrate our relationship to Christ don't become the actions that we think save us. Baptism, taking communion, church membership, tithing, praying twice a day, religious ritual, none of these things can save a person. Now, they're not bad. In fact, they're good if you are a believer. But they have no value and no meaning unless you have Christ in your heart. In Abraham's day, circumcision meant, "I am dedicated to God." And where a person was truly dedicated, it had legitimate meaning. Where they weren't, it became a ritual without reality. In the same way today, baptism, for example, is supposed to mean, "I have given my heart to Jesus Christ and he is my Saviour." When that is true, baptism is a wonderfully appropriate step of faith. But when that life change, that acceptance of Christ into your heart is not a reality, then baptism becomes meaningless and maybe even dangerous, because it may lead you to think you are a Christian when you actually aren't. Unfortunately today, many people put their trust in some outward factor as their hope for heaven. Some people trust in inherited religion. Oh, Dad was a deacon. Mum was a Sunday school teacher. They act as if salvation is inherited, just like you inherit the colour of your eyes. But it doesn't work that way when it comes to salvation. No one else can believe for you. You have to believe for yourself if you want forgiveness for your wrongs and an eternity with Jesus Christ. And so it all boils down to this, and it's those last five words, "only Jesus and Jesus only." In what are you trusting for your eternal salvation? Or more correctly, in whom are you trusting to take you to heaven? After all, salvation is not a what, it is a who. The issue is your relationship to Jesus Christ. And so these are the five simple words that I'd like you to take away this morning. If you forget everything else about the talk, that's all right. Remember five words: only Jesus and Jesus only. Only Jesus can save you, so put your trust in Jesus only. Let's pray.